Welcome back to the Deep Dive, the place where we take these really complex global finance challenges and, well, try to distill them into something genuinely valuable. You sent us a fascinating stack of sources this time, all focused on country risk, financial crisis, and the frankly dizzying world of sovereign debt restructuring.
Our mission today is to really trace the evolution of that world. We're going to start with the traditional framework, you know, the historical clubs that were built to handle default. Then we'll map the monumental shift caused by new strategic lenders like China.
And then the really interesting part.
And then we'll get to the really sophisticated positive sum financing mechanisms that are emerging today, specifically these debt for nature swaps. It's a journey from, let's say, rigid rules to creative collaboration.
That roadmap is perfect. But before we get to the players, let's nail down that one critical distinction. The thing that separates a temporary panic from a permanent disaster. I'm talking about the difference between liquidity and solvency. If a country is in crisis, how do we know which kind of crisis it is?
It's the core diagnostic question.
Yeah, exactly.
Is this a temporary cash flow problem? I mean, they have the money, just not right now. That's liquidity. Or is this something more fundamental, a structural inability to ever pay the debt back? That's solvency.
And there are actual numbers for this, right? Red flags.
Oh, yeah. To figure this out, analysts use a set of standard, often pretty rigid, thresholds that act as distress signals.
Okay, let's talk about solvency first, since that feels like the deeper long-term issue.
Solvency focuses on what they call stock variables, the total pile of debt versus the country's capacity to pay. The two biggest indicators are, first, the debt-to-GDP ratio. If that number consistently creeps over, say, 66%, that's a major flag.
Okay.
But maybe even more important for a sovereign nation is the debt-to-exports ratio.
Because exports bring in the dollars to pay the foreign debt.
Precisely. Exports generate the hard currency. So if that ratio gets above 150%, the country is just fundamentally overstretched.
Meaning it literally can't earn enough foreign currency to keep up with the interest, let alone the principal.
Yeah.
But liquidity, that sounds more like an immediate day-to-day panic.
Exactly. Liquidity problems are measured by flow variables. Can they make the next payment? So we look at things like the debt service ratio,
which is
the total required debt payment relative to export earnings. If that gets over 33% of exports, the cash flow is dangerously tight.
I guess the other one is just how much cash is in the bank.
Basically, yeah. The size of the central bank's reserves. If those reserves cover fewer than 6 months of imports, you have almost no buffer. No cushion against capital flight or any unforeseen shocks.
So the metrics dictate the cure. Can you give us a really sharp contrast? A solvency case versus a liquidity case.
Okay, take Greece during its crisis. Their debt-to-GDP ratio, it soared well past 250%.
Wow.
At that level, there's only one solution. A massive haircut, a significant debt reduction for creditors. You just can't grow your way out of that kind of overhang. But then you look at countries like, say, Tunisia or Morocco today. They might be struggling with low reserves or high short-term payments, but their long-term viability isn't fundamentally broken.
So they need a patch, not major surgery.
Exactly. They need immediate debt service relief, maybe some rescheduling or new money injections. It's a temporary fix for a liquidity squeeze, not a permanent write down. The key for stability is making sure the solution actually matches the problem.
Okay, so let's unpack that initial system, the one built to handle these problems, the traditional architecture with all the main creditor groups.
Right. So when a sovereign nation hits trouble, the negotiation table basically involves five key groups. In the official sector, you have the IFIs, the International Financial Institutions, so the IMF, the World Bank, and then the official bilateral creditors, who are governments. They're organized under the Paris Club.
And on the private side?
On the private side, you have private suppliers for trade debt. You have the international banks who organize themselves ad hoc as the London Club. And then finally, the group that's become more and more dominant, institutional investors. So mutual funds, hedge funds, the people holding the euro bonds.
Let's start with the Paris Club. This is the government-to-government debt, often tied to things like aid or trade guarantees.
Mm-hmm.
How central have they been to the whole global debt landscape?
Hugely central. I mean, they are the benchmark for how official debt is handled. Since its founding back in 1956, the 21 Paris Club member governments have hammered out, get this, 479 agreements for 102 different countries.
And in the dollar amount.
It covers a colossal $614 billion in official or officially guaranteed debt.
That is just a staggering figure. So what are the key rules that define the Paris Club? What keeps the system from just collapsing?
Well, they operate under seven guidelines, but three are absolutely foundational. First is consensus. All the creditors have to agree.
No lone wolves.
No. Second, and this is crucial, comparability of treatment. If the official creditors give a massive write-down, the private creditors have to be brought to the table to offer similar terms.
To prevent free riding.
Exactly. If they don't, the debtor country can't really benefit from the official relief.
And that comparability rule is the big sticking point in modern debt restructuring, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because trying to enforce it against hundreds of different private bondholders all over the globe is almost impossible.
Precisely. It was much easier to enforce when it was just the big banks and the London Club. It's a lot harder now with all those dispersed bondholders.
Okay. And the third rule?
The third key rule is, for me, the most interesting operational insight. They explicitly do not restructure post-cutoff date debt.
Wait. Why would you exclude the most recent debt? That feels really counterintuitive when a country is in deep trouble.
It's purely strategic. That debt, the money that came in after a specified date, is exempted from restructuring for one reason, to preserve the debtor's access to new financing.
Ah, I see.
If lenders know that any new money they provide today will just get thrown into the fire and written down tomorrow, they'll stop lending entirely. It's a mechanism designed to keep the patient alive while the surgery takes place.
That makes perfect sense. It separates the old bad debt from the emergency cash you need right now. Okay, shifting to the private side, let's talk about the London Club, those international banks, and the creation of the famous Brady Plan back in 1989.
Right. So the London Club was never a formalized body like the Paris Club. It was always an ad hoc gathering initiated by the debtor and often advised by the Institute of International Finance, the IF. They kind of coordinate the debt analysis for private creditors. And the Brady Plan, that was the big solution to the long, grinding Latin American debt crisis of the 1980s. Commercial bank debt had basically paralyzed half a continent.
So what made the Brady Plan such a landmark innovation?
It fundamentally de-risked and standardized defaulted bank debt. Before Brady, banks just held these illiquid, super risky loans on their books. The plan offered a menu-based exchange.
An exchange for what?
Banks swapped this defaulted debt for easily tradable Brady bonds. Now, this required them to take a pretty significant haircut, often around 35% debt cancellation, in exchange for the other 65% being converted into a new senior bond.
But the real genius was the collateral, right? How on earth did they convince banks to just accept that 35% loss right away?
You hit the nail on the head. The innovation that made the entire deal work was the collateralization mechanism. The principal of these new Brady bonds was guaranteed by 30-year, zero-coupon U.S. Treasury bonds.
The safest asset in the world.
Literally the safest asset in the world. The debtor country bought these treasuries using a mix of their own reserves and official financing support from the IMF and World Bank. So these old, risky bank loans were converted into new tradable debt where the final principal payment was guaranteed.
It stabilized the entire market. And it provided a template for future large-scale restructurings. I'm thinking of the 1997 Vietnam deal, or much later, the massive Greek debt restructuring between 2011 and 2015. That one involved an eye-watering 65% haircut.
That's right. And the Greek case really demonstrated the sheer scale of loss that private creditors could be forced to absorb when a country is absolutely fundamentally insolvent.
And here's where it gets really, really interesting. Because the legal battles from these deals have never stopped. The Brady era created tradable bonds, which in turn created this opportunity for holdout creditors. The hedge funds that buy defaulted debt for pennies on the dollar and then sue for full payment.
Indeed. These holdout creditors, often called vulture funds, are a massive disruption to that comparability of treatment rule we talked about. They essentially wait for everyone else to agree to a sensible deal, and then they use legal action, usually in New York or London courts, to demand a 100% recovery. It gums up the entire system.
And we saw a major response to that just recently.
Absolutely. The frustration with that strategy really reached a boiling point. Just this past March in 2024, New York lawmakers moved to limit how much these creditors can recover from defaulted sovereign debt.
Under New York law, which is where most of these contracts are based?
Exactly. This legislative attempt is designed to deter the holdouts from blowing up the broader and necessary restructuring process that benefits, you know, millions of citizens in the debtor country.
That brings us squarely into the modern era, where the traditional clubs find themselves struggling to coordinate a far more complex group of creditors. The sheer amount of money owed to new global players just makes the old Paris and London club methods less effective.
The whole structure of external liabilities has dramatically changed. It's created this unprecedented complexity and uncertainty. You can see this shift so clearly in the data. For countries that were eligible for the Debt Service Suspension Initiative, the DSSI.
The COVID-era relief plan.
Right. For those countries, the share of external debt owed to multilateral institutions like the World Bank dropped a lot, from 55% in 2006 down to 48% in 2020. And that debt was basically absorbed by Eurobonds, non-Paris Club creditors, and crucially, by China.
China is arguably the biggest game changer here. They're not in the Paris Club, and they operate under a totally different philosophy than the IMF.
China's role is enormous and unconventional. It now accounts for roughly 9.5 to 10% of all debt in default by creditors globally.
And its scale as a crisis lender is just massive.
It is. Since the year 2000, over 20 debtor countries have received something like $240 billion in Chinese rescue lending. They are truly acting as a global lender of last resort.
What's so fascinating is the variety of tools they use. It's not just a standard IMF-style package loan, is it?
Correct. They use a whole range of instruments that kind of blur the line between commercial and sovereign lending. You have traditional rescue loans from their state-owned banks, sure. But you also have these complex commodity prepayment facilities, like in Ecuador in 2009, where they were essentially pre-selling future oil for cash right now.
I've also read about the swap lines.
Yes, we see countries like Argentina and Turkey drawing heavily from the People's Bank of China swap lines, which are these mechanisms for exchanging currencies. It's a very different toolkit.
Let's talk about the cost. When a country is desperate, are these Chinese rescue loans cheaper than the traditional safety net?
No, not at all. In fact, they're significantly more expensive. The average borrowing terms from China across all its different state creditors hover around 5%.
And the IMF.
IMF loans average around 2.5%. And if you look at something like the U.S. Federal Reserve swap lines, they're often closer to 1%.
So why the huge premium? Is it just opportunistic lending, or is there a different risk calculation going on?
It's a bit of both. It reflects a commercial mandate and a higher risk perception. Unlike the IMF, which has preferred creditor status, meaning they get paid first no matter what, China doesn't have that same guarantee. Their state banks often act with a strong commercial mandate, so that higher rate compensates them for the risk, and perhaps more crucially, it reflects the strategic nature of the lending, which is often tied to specific projects or resources.
This complexity led the G20 to create the Common Framework to try and coordinate China, private creditors, and the Paris Club members.
Yeah.
And the Zambia restructuring. That was the ultimate test case, and it was a real struggle.
Zambia defaulted back in 2020. And the restructuring took 3 agonizing years. It was a litmus test because it forced all the official creditors, including China and India, to coordinate alongside private bondholders. The official lenders eventually agreed to modify $6.3 billion in debt. But critically, the private bondholders had to go beyond the terms offered by the official sector. They agreed to an 18% cut in face value, writing off about $700 million.
And the most important innovation, the part that ties the creditors' fate directly to Zambia's success, was the performance trigger.
Absolutely. That was the breakthrough. The agreement provides upfront relief, but the payments on a third of the new bonds are contingent on Zambia's economic performance.
So if Zambia does well, the creditors do better.
Exactly. If the economy grows faster than expected, based on key metrics like exports and tax revenue, the payments automatically rise.
That's a massive pivot. It's no longer a zero-sum game where creditors are just trying to lose the least amount of money. It actually introduces a shared upside.
It creates an alignment of incentives that was totally missing in the traditional system. It's a necessary evolution, really, given how complex the creditor landscape is today.
That shift from just managing a crisis to creating mutual upside brings us perfectly to our final section, the positive-sum game of debt conversion.
Debt conversion is all about designing a solution that solves a problem while also creating value for a specific goal, which is often environmental. It benefits 3 parties. The debtor gets debt cancellation or a local currency payment. The creditor gets to clean up their portfolio. And a third party, often a conservation group, gets access to local currency at a discount. It's like an investment subsidy for a critical project.
And the most famous example of this right now is the Debt for Nature Swap, or DNF. How does that mechanism actually work in practice?
A DNF is a purely voluntary transaction. A creditor, could be a government, could be a private investor, agrees to cancel or significantly reduce a debt owed by a developing country. In exchange, the debtor government commits to making an equivalent agreed-upon financial contribution, usually in local currency, to fund conservation projects run by a local trust fund.
So you turn a foreign currency debt obligation into a local currency promise to the environment.
That's a great way to put it. The country gets debt relief, and the environment gets dedicated funding.
Let's look at the trailblazers here, starting with the small island nation of Belize.
Belize became the blueprint in 2021. They restructured their only international bond, which was valued at $530 million, by buying it back from investors at 55 cents on the dollar.
Which they couldn't have afforded to do on their own.
No way. They leveraged capital from the Nature Conservancy, TNC, who facilitated the whole deal and provided the necessary insurance.
And they used that buyback discount to create a conservation fund.
Precisely. The enormous savings from the buyback were used to pre-fund a $23.4 million endowment. That endowment is dedicated in perpetuity to marine conservation, with Belize committing to protect 30% of its ocean.
It successfully channeled all that surging demand for ESG investing directly into balance sheet relief.
Exactly. And that blueprint was quickly adopted across the Caribbean, wasn't it?
It was. Barbados followed in 2022 using a blue loan and blue bonds, which were backed by guarantees from TNC and the Inter-American Development Bank.
And that structure let them buy back existing debt at a lower interest rate, channeling 100% of the savings into marine conservation, also committing to conserve 30% of their ocean.
But the biggest deal in terms of dollar value, the one that really cemented this as a mainstream mechanism, involved the crown jewel of biodiversity. The Galapagos.
Ecuador's 2023 DNF deal was just monumental in scale. They used this conversion to cancel $1.6 billion of their outstanding bonds.
$1.5 billion.
In exchange, they secured $450 million in conservation funding over 18 years. And this massive commitment was directly linked to extending the protected territory of the Galapagos archipelago, securing a truly global public good. The capital raised for that deal was the largest DNF ever.
And we are seeing this move beyond just marine protection now, too. I'm thinking of the recent deal in Central America with El Salvador.
That's a critical development. It shows the versatility of the model. In October 2024, El Salvador completed the world's largest conversion dedicated to a river watershed. They secured $1 billion in financing to repurchase over $1 billion of their bonds at a discount. The total lifetime savings, over $352 million, will specifically support conservation and ecosystem restoration in the crucial Lempa River watershed.
So it proves the structure works for large-scale land-based goals, not just pristine oceans.
It does.
This journey has been incredible. We've gone from the rigid, consensus-driven negotiations of the mid-20th century Paris Club through the complex, multi-creditor world disrupted by China's rescue lending. And we've landed on these deeply creative DNF transactions driven by global environmental mandates.
The big takeaway is that sovereign debt restructuring is still a very complex patchwork system. It's forcing constant innovation. But the growth of these large-scale conservation-linked debt swaps suggests a viable and, I think, necessary path forward. It's one that successfully integrates economic relief with preserving these global public goods.
It moves the conversation beyond just deciding who takes the loss.
Right. To creating new value for everyone involved.
So what does this all mean for the future of global finance? I mean, given the demonstrable success of these debt for nature swaps in mobilizing huge investment for environmental goals, this raises a pretty important question. Will governments soon be forced to guarantee climate and sustainability spending within the terms of all future debt restructuring agreements? In effect, making ESG criteria a mandatory, non-negotiable part of any future bailout.
That's a fascinating implication, isn't it? The private sector is already leading the way. It may only be a matter of time before the official sector deals have to catch up.
Thank you for joining us on the Deep Dive. We hope this exploration helps you see the shifting landscape of global debt in a whole new light.